Now, for the past several years, we've become more and more aware of how women who went into the so-called mother and baby homes were treated. Many had their babies taken illegally. Others felt pressurised to give them up. Some were consigned to a life of hard labour in laundries. What still remains clouded in so much secrecy is the extent of the state's involvement in those homes and indeed the role of the nuns and clergy in running them. Well, my next guest is a journalist. She's Caelan Hogan. She's written her first book. It's called The Republic of Shame, and it's about those institutions. Caelan, before we get into the details and the nitty-gritty of the book, tell us a little bit about your own background. You're just...
So I'm from Dublin, yeah. And I've worked for years now as a freelance journalist, mainly working abroad, reporting on the conflict in Syria. I was reporting in Nigeria and in South Africa for publications like the New York Times Magazine and National Geographic. But in 2017, I was back in Ireland. I was doing some writing about the housing crisis. I'd written before about direct provision,
yeah.
And those institutions. And it was, you know, a time where there was a growing public awareness, of course, about the experiences of women and of survivors in these institutions.
Right.
And it was quite a pivotal year. It was a few years after the marriage equality referendum, when I think that question of who gets to be a family was a very painful debate that resurfaced. And we were looking, ahead to 2018 with, the repeal referendum, the papal visit, and also the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes was due to issue its final report.
Right.
That, of course, has been delayed. And for me, I think coming back, I realised how little I personally knew about what happened in these institutions. And I think that's true for a lot of people, despite the incredible reporting that has been done by many journalists, the survivors and researchers have been speaking about these issues for years. But there still is, I think, questions about what happened inside these institutions.
But did you find any answers?
I spoke to many people, and I there were more people than I expected there to speak to. This is something that I think we see as being in the past, but there are so many lives that are still affected by our current legislation and by the legacy of these institutions and the shame that
well,
sort of fueled them.
I think it's interesting, and I noted it obviously in the title as well, is shame was everywhere. And I know, because I've spoken to some nuns from those institutions, and they are ashamed. But families, the shame you could bring on your family, families threw people out. There's blame to be assigned more or less all over the gaff, except to fathers.
Well, I think that actually fathers, and that's speaking with the nuns, that was something that came up a lot. Where were the fathers?
Yeah.
And, it's something that going into it, I had, when I was speaking to people and first understanding their experiences, I thought, we don't hear the stories of fathers. But actually, there was one woman I spoke to, she's nearly 81 now. She was in Tuam twice, sent to Tuam twice, and she gave birth to two children. And the second time, it was a boyfriend who she was very much in love with and who wanted to marry her, and who actually came and visited her in Tuam. And they would not let him see his daughter. The nuns allowed him to come in and see her, but they would not let him see his child or to take his child home.
Really?
So there were fathers who were silenced,
right,
as well by,
yeah,
this shame.
But, I mean, by and large, I remember my mother telling me about some woman when she finally thought I was old enough, I might have been, I don't know, ancient at that age, that there existed single mothers, because it's a sin, and that it was her employer, who was a solicitor and a very upright man in the town, and not a mention of punishment for him, but she actually kept her baby. But anyway, I digress. But that there was shame everywhere across society, families ashamed, women ashamed.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, going back to one mother told me she felt like she was from outer space because just these, you know, these experiences weren't spoken about. Women didn't, you know, it was a huge culture of secrecy. But, you know, it was sin. It was a morality that did originate in the church. And, you know, the church facilitated this system that confined women for being pregnant outside of marriage, which again goes back to the church's own morality and its own sort of authority. I think that, you know, women being pregnant outside of wedlock challenged the authority of the church. And that's one reason why they were confined.
Because they became sinners.
Because, you know, the Catholic morality teaches us we shouldn't have sex outside of marriage.
That's right. And well, that's fair enough. That's their teaching.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, that, I think, influenced. When we say, you know, there was huge shame among families, where did that shame originate? And I think, you know, it was something that was taught through the church, was that there was a right and wrong, and these women had done wrong, and they were treated as offenders.
Yeah,
fallen women. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And but I mean, what I'm trying to get is a picture of the time. The neighbours, what would the neighbours say? Like, you couldn't hold your head up in the town if you were a member of the family. All that kind of thing.
I mean, even I was born in 1988 and I was, you know, my mum wasn't married. She was living with my dad. But there was, you know, a feeling that this was a bit of a scandal, that there was still shame around this, even in 1988. And when I began to speak with people, I realised how recently all this happened. I think people often say it was of the time, but we're talking about a time frame from the 1920s to the 1990s. I even came across one institution, a mother and baby home, open till 2006.
Yes, tell us about that. That's in Donegal.
So that's in Donegal in a small town called Newtown Cunningham. And this was an institution that was set up in the 1980s and which remained open until 2006. So I went to the small town and I managed to speak to the woman who actually ran it for all those years. And she, you know, explained that mothers would come. It was the same. It wasn't run by nuns, but it was, you know, run in association with the local diocese. And women would come and stay, you know, in the last months of their pregnancy and would, you know, write letters back home pretending they were working somewhere else. She spoke of one woman who's, you know, went back home with her baby, but the local priest wouldn't baptize the child because, you know, he didn't agree with the fact that she was an unmarried mother. And this institution was deeply connected with the Catholic pro-life crisis pregnancy agencies like Cura and like Life.
Right, yeah.
Which Bishop Kevin Doran was involved with setting up the Life agency. So it was very much to do with preventing women travelling for abortions.
Yeah, well, you see, that's kind of fair enough. If that's your belief that it is wrong to have an abortion, and if you set up something that is humane and kind...
Well, I think it was still the huge amount of judgment and stigma these women were facing, and they were not given, you know, necessarily, I think, a free choice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I didn't realise until I read it that it had existed. But many years ago, there was an organisation called Ally. I think it was set up in the 60s by a man called Father Fergal O'Connor, I think was his name. He was Dominican. And it was a very similar notion that you could get in touch with Ally if you were pregnant, and they would have volunteer families all around the country. So if you were, say, from Donegal, you might go and stay with a family in Portlaoise, and then they would arrange for your letters to have a British stamp or whatever to send home. Like, that's who we were.
Yeah, one of the women in the book, one of the mothers, she did go through Ally, but she actually had to leave the family because she said she was treated as a sort of an unpaid servant. And she was there one night when there was a party going on and she could hear them sort of joking about her and talking about how she got pregnant. So, you know, I think it wasn't always a great experience for women in these homes either.
Right, okay.
And it was, you know, they were treated as, you know, almost a charity case. And so it was still still continuing that culture of secrecy and confinement. And during those years, you know, that was an initiative that happened, but the institutions were still open. You know, BESPRA was operating under, you know, the Sisters of Sacred Hearts until 1988 as a mother and baby home. Sorry, 1998. I did meet a woman who was born in BESPRA in 1988, same year I was born, through an apartment viewing. I went to view an apartment and we got chatting, and it turned out she was born there and adopted from there. And she's only just beginning to search for her mother. And that really made me realize that, you know, people are still facing huge barriers to accessing information about their own identity, their own birth information. We don't give people that right. There's people still trying to trace each other, both, you know, mothers yeah. and their children. And there's still such barriers in place. And some mothers still feel, you know, a fear and a stigma. So those attitudes, you know,
well, you might have a mother who subsequently got married, had a family, didn't tell her husband, didn't fear, shame.
Mm-hmm. And we can see how pervasive that stigma has been, how strong that stigma was, you know. And I think it really raises the question of whether these women actually had a choice, and how free their consent was to the adoptions that took place, when we can see how powerful that stigma still is. And so when they, you know, they were sent to these institutions, and, you know, they might have signed a paper consenting to an adoption, but did they really have freedom of consent? And, you know, women I spoke to
a very fair question.
Women who gave birth in these institutions told me they were, you know, they were both, you know, made to work when they were there for free. Their names were changed. One woman who was in BESPRA in the 70s, Anna Gorman, her baby died there, and, you know, she was made to work up until almost the moment she gave birth, and she was given no information about what happened to her child. She's still searching for where her daughter is buried. And so, you know, there was a real system of control, but also more subtle sort of ways of influence, being told that they would be selfish to keep their child because they were an unmarried mother and they couldn't give their child the future that child deserved. So making them feel like they couldn't be mothers, and that, you know, they would be doing something terrible to their own child by keeping their child, by raising it, you know.
And of course, there was no state assistance then for single mothers. That came much, much later. But what was really news to me was that families paid money into the institutions. I thought this was charitable by the nuns.
Yeah, no money. There were definitely private donations given. There's an institution called, you know, Temple Hill, that was run by St. Patrick's Guild, that was around the corner from my house. You know, this is so close to home. These institutions were, I walked past it every day on the way to school. And mothers were expected and made to pay. A nurse who worked there said that the nuns would go out and sort of turn up on the front door if the money wasn't paid. There is evidence that mothers paid for their babies to be there even after their babies had been adopted. So they believed that their babies were still in the institution, were paying money, but the child was actually gone, in some cases illegally adopted. The woman I mentioned from Tuam, Rose, we tried to search for her records, and we found in the archives that her family had begun to pay money for her son to remain in Tuam after she left. And I think that was probably a condition for her to leave the institution, that they had to pay money. And we think about the death rate in Tuam and the number of children who died and the way they were buried, the fact that families were actually paying the nuns for this.
It seems extraordinary. It really does, because, and the nuns that you spoke to, you know, I presume many of them had nothing to do with this, was before their time. What was their attitude?
Well, I did speak to nuns who worked within the institutions. I spoke with a midwife who worked in St. Patrick's, which was the biggest mother and baby home in Ireland. And she, you know, remembered very vividly women coming in. One came in with two corsets. She'd been wearing two corsets for a long time to hide her pregnancy. She lived at home. And there was another woman who came in with a map because she was going to pretend she was away working somewhere. And, you know, she was writing these letters in Norway. She was, you know, and the nun was terrified she was going to be found out. Just keep it simple. But, it, you know, for the religious sisters, you know, they did look back and say there were abuses. You know, one sister did tell me she had been in the Magdalen Laundry as a novice, and she told me there were abuses. We made mistakes. It was terrible. The women were called penitents. They were called offenders. You know, I think there is, you know, a shame about that, but also a silence, I think, a prevailing silence. I did go to the effort as much as I could to speak with individual nuns, but on an institutional level, it was difficult. I reached out to the Sisters of the Sacred Heart that ran three institutions in Ireland, and initially they were very willing to speak to me and actually gave me a list of names of nuns who were still alive, who had worked in these institutions, who had first-hand experience and who might have answers about what happened there. And then, of course, lawyers stepped in, public relations stepped in, because these are institutions that, you know, need to sort of protect their interests, I think. And that the conversation was shut down and there was just a prevailing silence. And that order, you know, we had the burials report recently come out that said that the affidavit that they had given in was misleading and speculative. So there is a feeling that there isn't, the whole story is not being told, and that there are answers that these religious orders could still be giving.
You did a lot of work in the archives in Dublin, which I gather had a lot of information, but in other sections of the country, no.
I did. I went to the Diocese of Killaloe, which is in Ennis.
Yeah.
And actually, that was one of the most striking records, as I found letters between the local health board and the bishop at the time, Bishop Fogarty. And that was from the 1930s. And it was the local health board asking him his opinion on what should be done about unmarried mothers. So, you know, the state asking for direct authority from the church on what to do about women who are pregnant, which should be a health issue. And he broke down the women into three classes of offenders. This is his language. First class offenders, second class offenders, and third class offenders. First were naturally decent women who he said, you know, we could send to the institutions like Sean Ross Abbey, which is well known for the film Philomena. And the second class and third class, and this was based on the number of children they had had, if they were repeat offenders, as if they were criminals. And the third offenders were described by him, by a bishop, as being of a wild and vicious nature, and that they should be sent to the Magdalen Laundries, I would assume for life, because they were described as being a bad influence, as in some way contagious, because they had had sex outside of marriage.
Outside of marriage, yeah. And it would appear were unrepentant.
Well, that was, I think, the church's prerogative was to make them repentant. You know, I think these institutions can often be shown as, you know, being refuges or places where women who had nowhere to go were sent, but women were kept there for several years in some cases and made forced to work to redeem themselves. It was a Catholic morality. It was about, you know, paying for your sin.
Right. Let me go to some of the calls. I was born in Bessborough in 1993. Now, that's fairly recent, I would have thought. My mother was a young woman, and as she chose to keep me, my mother was separated from the other women. This was in 1993. Shocking behaviour that I would argue was state-sponsored. You would concur.
Well, the state was paying for women to be in these homes, even though Bessborough was a private institution run by the Sisters of Sacred Hearts. And that goes to show there's people that, you know, were born in the 90s who were only starting to search for their mothers if they were adopted, or, you know, who stayed with their mothers, you know, because in those times, you know, women were sort of more supported and had ways to actually raise their children.
And society was changing.
Well, and the church, the authority of the church church was waning because that was the time the abuse scandals were coming out. I think my generation was the first generation to grow up in a time when the church was questionable. We, you know, their authority could be questioned because we were realising how much had been covered up.
I was adopted in 1968. Tusla will only give me my birth weight and say I was born in England, nothing else.
This is something that's so painful for people who were born in the institutions and who are trying to find out basic information, their own names, what they were, you know, what their mothers called them when they were born. Sometimes even their adoptive parents' names are redacted from these files. So they'll go through this huge process of trying to apply for their files through Freedom of Information, which is their right to have their own personal records. And it'll just be huge sections that are blanked out. And it does give the impression that there is an ongoing culture of secrecy around this issue.
Right. I mean, we'll have it discussed in the Dáil as well. Do you see any... I don't know. I mean, I know somebody, we had him on the programme, and his birth mother wants to have absolutely nothing to do with him. Do you see any of her side of that story?
I think that the mothers still feel a lot of stigma and fear. I spoke with a mother who, you know, hasn't told her children yet and is searching now for her son. But, you know, she just doesn't know how to tell her children that she had a child. But I think as that stigma starts to go away and women realise that they're not going to be judged, I think, you know, it's a fear as well of how could you
have lied
stay
to me.
Silent
yeah.
about this.
Yeah.
But I think there's always understanding about this. You know, I think the book is very important. Was very important for me to realise the huge pressure that mothers were under, that this was not necessarily a free choice and that they were under so much judgment and stigma from both, you know, state and church. You see those records calling them offenders, treating them like criminals.
Mm.
So I think the more there is a realisation that there is, you know, understanding for those women and the more we really understand the legacy of this shame and the ongoing sort of shame that is perpetuated through the legislation that doesn't give people right to their identity, that is trying to seal records. There's an attempt to seal the records from the Commission on Child Abuse for 75 years. So I think encouraging people to speak about their experiences is really important.
Okay. I had to do that. I'm 71 now and my daughter is 48. My whole life I've walked around drenched in shame. It's a very, very powerful kind of statement. My parents took in single pregnant ladies to our home when we were kids 50 years ago. The young ladies were mainly from rural areas and we looked after them until they were driven into the hospital in labour by my dad. These ladies returned to us for about 4 weeks, no baby, and they subsequently went home as really sad individuals. I have no idea who set up these arrangements, and my late parents never discussed it with us. Another caller, of course, I'm horrified at the cruelty, etc., of mother and baby homes. However, I feel she's judging the past by the standards of the present. That's from Brenda in Dublin.
Well, what is the past when these institutions were open till the 90s and one was open till 2006? That is a common thing I'm told, is it was the times or this was the past. But these attitudes also are pervasive in the church. We have Bishop Kevin Doran saying that, you know, contraception takes away the freedom of saying no to unwanted sex for women, or that it encourages same-sex marriage. So still in opposition to contraception. And
but that's the teaching of the church. Now, I think it is reasonable to say that it is widely ignored. I mean, it was the first big, I suppose, battle that was won against that particular piece of, because practicing Catholics decided they wanted to control the size of their... But it's still the teaching of the church.
Right, and this
which they're entitled to do.
And this is not an attack on anyone's faith. And many of the survivors I spoke to are people of faith.
Yeah.
Are strongly religious, but do feel let down by their church. You know, there was one man who was born in Chum, and he went to his local priest asking for some information and was told, leave that be. You know, so a lack of effort on the church, I think, to find answers for people and to right. engage with survivors.
What do you expect when we get the report?
The commission's report, which is due out next year in February, hopefully. For that mother, you know, for women like Anne O'Gorman who are still searching for where their own children are buried, who don't know where their children are buried. There was a burials report, but it didn't give any answers for, you know, a lot of mothers, a lot of families still searching. We also, you know, it should report on the conditions within the homes, why these children died, why so many died, and also the consent that was given by mothers, that is something that is within their remit, is to see whether this, you know, whether consent was freely given and what the nature of these adoptions were.
Okay. Listen, Caelan Hogan, thank you very, very much indeed. It's your first book, so congratulations on that. And it's called The Republic of Shame.